Khazar king has just been told by the rabbi that there is a fifth order of creation. And this fifth order of creation is distinct from the normal level of humanity. Normal human beings do not possess a certain trait that he just described when talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was able to, as he described in paragraph 41, he was a superman who could, and I borrowed that term not from the comic books, but from Nietzsche. I hope you caught the reference. But he said he could walk through fire unscathed. He could know the future. He could know what would happen to him before he died. He would die peacefully. He could see all of the future history unfolding before him. Yes, so this is a kind of person that what is being described over here is, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the epitome of the prophetic experience, of prophecy. And for what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has described, what makes certain human beings of a fifth order of creation completely different, a completely different order of creation, a different species of creation from other human beings, is their ability to have this prophetic divine experience of complete conjunction with God. And as I mentioned to you, what's going to become apparent from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is that the only human beings on this earth that are capable of having this kind of higher order of connection with God are people that are descended from Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. If you are holy and you are determined to conjoin with God on a very, very deep and high level, you will be limited in your ability to do so just by virtue of the fact that you don't possess the proper pedigree, you don't have the right genetic material contained within your essence to be able to reach this level of prophecy that only Jews are capable of achieving. Now, that's not to say that all Jews necessarily will be able to reach this level. There may be other qualifications as well that he has not told us, but one thing we do know is that if you're not Jewish, you cannot achieve prophecy for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. There is something essential within the DNA, I don't know, again, we talked about using that as a borrowed term, within the DNA of the Jewish people that makes us unique, and that only we, our people, can achieve prophecy and no one else. The Khuzari said in paragraph 42, what you've described is for a divine angelic creature, and he said, well, you know, in paragraph 43, he said, but this is what I've described for you are some of the qualities of one of our prophets, Moshe Rabbeinu. The other peoples have also accepted his prophecies. It was through Moshe that the Jewish nation learned of their divine role and realized that they have a God who deals with them according to his will based on their behavior toward him. Moshe told the Jews things that were hidden from them, such as how the world was created and what mankind was like before the great flood. And of course, he's explaining that Moshe knew this because of a direct communication that he received from Hashem. He told them how they were descended from Adam, how the flood occurred, and how the 70 nations of the world all descended from Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefes. He told them how the world developed different languages in connection with the Tower of Babel, where the different nations settled, how different crafts developed, and how the countries grew. He chronicled for them the years from Adam to the present. He's basically described the first part of the book of Bereshit up until Parshas Lech Lecha, and there's a purpose for his describing this in the context of our discussion of the prophetic experience, because he wants to demonstrate that Moshe Rabbeinu knew everything. He knew all that had occurred in the past. He knew all that would occur in the future based upon his ability to communicate and receive communication directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now we're going to go off in a tangent. We're going to talk about the chronicling of the biblical history. And we're going to go off a little bit off of that in our next discussion, and how this connects to our present discussion of the prophetic abilities that exist uniquely within the Jewish people. But for our purposes today, this is where we're going to hold our text. So we started off on our discussion of the unique, of this sort of eugenic description of what makes the Jewish people chosen, what makes us special. And it's, as I mentioned to you, it's one of the most controversial points that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi makes in the Kuzari, and it's sort of what's succeeded in getting the Jewish people into a lot of trouble. Over the centuries, one of the reasons why, or at least one of the excuses for the existence of anti-Semitism in the world, is this kind of sense that some other nations of the world have, that the Jewish people hold themselves as being the chosen people, which means that we are a superior people, we hold ourselves above the rest of the world. And the backlash of that kind of theology has sometimes been persecution at the hands of anti-Semites, who have a tremendous resentment that what makes you think that you're any better than me? Yeah? So it's certainly understandable if someone in this room were to say, I am deeply uncomfortable with this form of theology which describes the Jewish people as somehow being inherently, ontologically different, not a different species of human being, and so forth. I will tell you this much. There are a lot of advantages to it as well. One of the best ways to prevent an intermarriage, you know, if you ever find yourself, God forbid, in a position where a family member of yours is contemplating marrying someone out of the faith, one of the ways to prevail, one of the ways to present an argument that would dissuade that individual from entering into such a relationship is to say, you're not compatible because. And why are a Jew and a non-Jew not compatible? Well, we love each other, all of our interests are the same, neither of us is particularly into our religion, right? So religion is not going to be an issue, we'll worry about it, we'll let our kids decide for themselves how they want to be raised, you know, all of the standard answers that you can think of, yes? But at the end of the day, if you subscribe to the theology of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, what you can present to the person is there is something essentially different between a Jewish neshama and a non-Jewish neshama. So that on the deepest of levels, even if you're compatible in all other ways, but on the deepest level, which is something that is spiritual, which is not quantifiable, not definable, not something that we can gauge, there will come a point where that will emerge in your relationship and you will feel a sense of not being fulfilled as a result. So I've seen it work. There's something that gnaws at the pintle of yid within every one of us that sort of helps us recognize that there's something that, and you know, we're a little bit conflicted, right? Because on the one hand, there's something that is appealing about this theology, but on the other hand, there's something that's repulsive about this theology as well. And are you sympathetic with my difficulty with it? Does it resonate with you? Okay. Let's delve into a little bit of Jewish scholarship for just a second.
What about a convert?
That's a good question. May I defer that question? Because it's very thorny for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. You won't like my answer. So I'm going to defer that. I'm going to defer and pretend like I don't know the answer to the question for now. And we'll figure it out later, okay? But I promise you, we will. If you stick it out, we will get to that. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi will directly address converts at some point down the road. Okay. In 1971, Jacob Katz, who was Olav HaShalom, who was a professor at Hebrew University, he was raised Orthodox and learned in yeshivas in Europe, died at a very old age, was very active till very, very late in life. He wrote a book called, his specialty was trying to understand the various different modes of religious practice among Jews throughout the medieval period, going into the modern period. And he wrote it, and especially when it came to relations between Jews and non-Jews, that was something of special interest to him. And he wrote in 71, he wrote a book called Tradition in Crisis, Jewish Society at the End of the Middle Ages. And bear with me now, because we're gonna move away from traditional texts now, just to be able to understand a certain passage, which will bring us back to Reb Yehuda Halevi. Do me a favor. Let's just try an exercise. Take the lady sitting next to you, and I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to this text. Take a couple of minutes to read the text to yourselves, and then let's discuss it. Okay? The place where you're jumping into this text is as follows. You're going to start with the very first line. Christianity had ceased to be regarded as an idolatrous cult. And what Katz is talking about is the tracing the historical trends of forbidden Gentile wine. Now, we know that there's such a halacha. Let me set this up for you, and then I'll send you off on your way. We know that there's a halacha that Gentile wine is prohibited. The wine of Christians and the wine of, certainly of Christians, and then there's a discussion in the Rambam whether the wine of Muslims is prohibited, but for now we know it's the wine of Christians that is prohibited, and I gave a shiur one Monday night about it, which is available on Kosher too. And the question is, why is it prohibited? The rabbis forbade what's known as stam yeinam, that even wine. Originally, the Torah only prohibits wine that's used in the actual practice of idolatry. The rabbis extended that prohibition, that all non-Jewish wine, even if it's just manufactured for sale, not for idolatry, all Gentile wine is prohibited. And that prohibition has been in effect for centuries. And that's why we have to have special kosher wineries. Now, what Katz does is he traces a very interesting historical phenomenon. Originally, the emphasis on the reason for the prohibition of Gentile wine was because this was a way of preventing any mixing between Jews and Christians, because the fear was that Christianity was such a similar breakaway cult, breakaway sect of Judaism, that the idea of having gatherings between Jews and Christians and having wine over those disputations, discussions, and so forth, would result in a blurring of the lines between Judaism and Christianity, to the point where we would lose people to the faith. Yeah? And Judaism would become permanently scarred and distorted by Christian influence. And as a result, one of the ways to prevent that from happening is that the rabbis forbade Christian wine to make sure that there would be a very strong divide between the Jewish and Christian communities, so that Judaism would remain pristine and would not be affected by Christianity.
They didn't know about scotch.
They said, yeah, that's true. Sherry casks, not cherry casks. Anyway, but in the end, this became less of a concern, because when Christianity emerged as its own religion, so that there was no longer any danger of Jews actually thinking that Christianity was a legitimate form of Judaism, there was an evolution of theology as far as the attitude towards Christian wine. And as a matter of fact, there's a recently book by one of the Soloveitchiks called The Manufacture of Wine Bimei HaBeinayim, during the medieval period, which I have in my library. It's one on my to-do list, but I'm sure he discusses this as well. Take a look at what Katz has to say, and just read until down to the end of the page with your chavrusa, and then we'll take literally 2 minutes, and then we'll talk about it. Go ahead. So let's unpack it a little bit. Let's figure out what is Katz trying to present to us? What kind of theological evolution took place over the course of the centuries as the divide between Christianity and Judaism became more stark and more recognizable? Would anyone like to suggest what kind of evolution he's describing in this passage? Anyone? Yes, Elaine.
There's a distinction between those who accepted the Torah and those who didn't. And so it's a different mindset of the people who remain Jewish and those who went away from it.
Well, the Christians argue that they did accept the Torah as well, right? So what kind of divide is he creating, or is he presenting that was taking place over the centuries?
Well,
And they descended from different Jews from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the Gentiles from Esau.
Yes, right. That's true. There's a familial divide between them as well.
Actually, it's less of a divide. Actually, it's more of a commonality. Esau and Yaakov, they're brothers from the same mother and father, which is...
Yes, but there's still, at one point, the family line divides, yes?
I just actually wanted to ask the question about Esau. Is he not considered son of Yaakov because he
Son of Isaac.
Son of Isaac.
Yeah. Yes, he's considered to have lost whatever special quality the Jewish people inherited from their fathers and grandfathers. Esau has forfeited as a result of forfeiting his birthright.
But yeah, Christianity, that's not from
Esau. Esau traditionally, Talmudically, comes from Esau. Yes. The Gemara represents Christianity as being from the people of Esau. And the reason why is because Edom, or Rome, is, according to the Talmud, identified as the nation that's descended from Esau. So whenever we find Esau and Yaakov in Midrashic literature, it's really just a code name for Rome versus Israel. Okay. So, what he's getting at over here in this passage is that over the course of the centuries, when there was no longer the theological battle to fight anymore between Christians and Jews, because that battle is over. We're not debating whether we should be Christians or Jews. We already know we're committed to Judaism. So then why should we prohibit Gentile or Christian wine anymore? There's no danger, or there's less of a danger for assimilation on theological grounds. Then we have to go to what he calls the essentialist kind of argument, which is that there's something essentially tainted about Christian wine, because by virtue of the fact that Jews and Christians are essentially different. And he talks about this idea, which is what I wanted you to pick up on. He says, both the Midrash and philosophers like Yehuda Halevi traced religious and historical differences to the dissimilar character of Jew and non-Jew, respectively. And he writes, it's irrelevant whether these differences were based on biological or racial sources or to divergent reactions to a particular historical and metaphysical event. In other words, what makes us essentially different from non-Jews? Is it the fact that it's something in our genetic material that was passed down to us from our ancestors? Or is it because we were privy to a certain kind of revelatory experience that the other nations never had? Either way, it makes no difference. But the bottom line is that there's something essentially different between us and the other nations that makes it taboo for us to partake of Christian wine, because it's going to taint us, because the very essence of the non-Jew infuses a certain impurity within the wine that he manufactures. So here you have basically what Katz is describing is a model for how the Jewish people were able to reinforce the ban on Christian wine when there was no longer a theological threat from the Christian world. That threat is converted into an essentialist kind of threat, that we cannot have anything manufactured by Christians because it's tainted essentially through the fact that they made it. Yes?
Back to the Khazari. From what I recall, when he was explaining, when Rabbi Yehuda was explaining about the different species in nature, he denied, when challenged, that he was putting the Jews aside, but only focused his differences on the prophetic Moshe-like class. So now you're saying that the Jews are being separated?
Right. The Jews are being separated. If you take a look on page 71, remember, this: the reason why we got into this discussion in the first place is at the bottom of paragraph 27. He says, rather, we Jews are obliged to follow the Torah because God took us out of Egypt and attached his glory to us. God did this specifically for us, as we are the choicest of all mankind. We, the Jewish people, are the choicest of all mankind. So what does that mean, to be the choicest of all mankind? Now he describes what makes us choicest, what makes us different, what makes us elevated above all human beings. and that is our ability to have a prophetic experience. Only Jews can have that prophetic experience, the Jews who left Egypt. Doesn't mean all of them will, but all of them have the potential, and whereas Gentiles do not. Gentiles have no potential for the prophetic experience. So I want to address what Katz is driving at. He is presenting to us a historical backdrop for how or why this kind of theology becomes desirable. It becomes more in vogue, or it becomes more important for the Jewish people when we try to define differences between us and the non-Jewish world that have nothing to do with ideas, but really have to do with the fact that we're just not compatible. And this is the Jews' way from using the sociological arguments that Katz is presenting, this is the way that Jews cope to remain distinct and apart from the rest of the world, even in societies where there's no longer a war of creed, there's no longer a war of ideas, and yet there's still an urgency for the Jewish people to remain distinct and unique. Now, there's a lot to say about this, and there's a lot of commentary that has to go into this when we try to present this in a more contemporary setting. I was just having this discussion with one of my sons at the Shabbos table, because he presented a beautiful Devar Torah that really the bottom line was that it was talking about, he had received it from the yeshiva where he attends, where one of his rebbeim had told him a story about how even the nice traits of the goyim should not be admired, because eventually, since they are not holy, they will not use their positive traits in the proper fashion. And we talked about whether there's any redemptive qualities at all within non-Jews. And this is a big discussion, and it's an important discussion, because invariably, your children are going to be presented with the idea that there has to be a very strong divide between Jews and non-Jews. And I certainly feel that has to be at some point presented to our children, because we have to make sure that our children don't look at the outside world and feel that that's just, that whatever they're doing is okay for us to do as well. So at some point we have to make sure that they understand that there are certain cultural values and social and moral values that the outside world has that are not acceptable to us. However, I think that we have to be very careful, and I guess it goes to a similar to thing that I addressed on Shabbos morning about the drush, about what it means, the definition of Kedusha. If our sole definition of defining who we are as a people is that we're not the Gentiles, so then we certainly have something to be worried about. If the emphasis of the message that we give over to our children is look how different we are from them, and look how bad they are, so then that's a message of negativity, which is not really going to do it for our kids. It's not really going to engender a sense of love for Yiddishkeit. It's just going to remind them how we are different, and how the goyim are a shlechte goyim, the shikir is a goy, and all of these other things that you're used to hearing from growing up. And do we understand why our children are being given that message? It's a concern that they're going to assimilate. It's a concern they're going to embrace certain values that we as parents and we as educators feel are unhealthy for our children. Absolutely. But again, it goes to the way that we present it, the degree to which we present it, the emphasis, and so forth. First and foremost, our message has to be to our kids, it's wonderful to be a Jew. And it's only when they become so universalistic in their thinking that they want to embrace the entire world with the beauty of Torah, then we have to insert a certain message of there is Asher Bochar Bonu Mikol HaAmim, that God chose us from among all the other nations, and He did make us distinct, and we have a special purpose, and we have a special mission. But again, this essentialist doctrine is something that we have to know how to approach it, and we have to know how to apply it, and especially when we're dealing and just having this discussion with our children. So there's a lot to discuss here. What I want to, yes, okay, let's take some points, yes, go ahead.
So just talking about being the children, so sorry for backtracking a little, and I'm sorry to everybody. What if you had a child born of a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father, so then you're saying that the child is Jewish. So which part of the soul, then, is that still a Jewish neshama? And if the converse is the fact that it's a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, does the Jewish father's soul hold less validity, or how?
No, it's an excellent question.
What happens to that neshama?
Yes, it's an excellent question. Why is matrilineal descent the criterion for defining Jewishness?
So that I can imagine. You can see as soon as a baby it is, sort of thing, but...
No, but it has to, but I would use the analogy of genetics in the same way. You know, there are certain traits that are only passed through the X chromosome. Okay, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. But in other words, there's, I don't know a lot, but this much I do know. There's the X chromosome, which is the female, and there's the Y chromosome, which is the male. There are certain genetic dispositions that can only be passed through the X chromosome. There are certain genetic dispositions that can only be passed through the Y chromosome, yes? So it's not surprising that we would say that that there are certain spiritual genetics that can only be passed through the X chromosome and not the Y chromosome, yeah? So is that a good analogy? Does that help you at all? In other words, Jewishness, the Jewish neshama, that certain metagene, that certain quality that allows us to have the prophetic experience, is passed through the mother. It's not passed through the father.
There was a time when was.
Okay, that's true. That was before this was crystallized.
Yes, I was wondering then, to what degree do we owe respect to someone who clearly follows the Noahide laws? If we are separating from them, are they not worthy of a true follower of the Noahide laws with non-Jew? Is he not worthy of good respect?
There's no question. I don't think even Rebbe Yehuda Halevi would have a problem with showing respect. Everyone was created, B'Tselem Elohim, everyone was created in God's image. Even Gentiles who don't observe the Noahide laws deserve respect if they do valorous deeds. And so this is not an issue of whether we respect people or not. It's a question of how we view a certain hierarchical order of creation and where we place ourselves versus the rest of the world. Now, I think really what your broader question is, what are the ramifications of this? What are the repercussions of this? And this is an important question to ask, because a lot of people have a very serious problem with Rebbe Yehuda Halevi, because they tend to translate this into, well, look at all of the other nations of the world who had eugenic theories. All you have to do is look at Nazi Germany, who viewed Jews as being subhumanists on some level, and they used that as the pretense to go and exterminate and commit genocide. So isn't this a dangerous theology? Well, one answer to that is no, it's not dangerous, it's neutral. You don't do anything with this unless you have malice in your heart. You can use something like this to kill and exterminate, but if you have no malice in your heart and you have respect for all of God's creatures, but you recognize that there are some with more and some with less, look, do I go over to a tree and pull off a branch because it's not the apple? Right? In other words, I don't have malice towards branches and leaves because they're not the fruit of the tree. Just because the Jewish people represent the fruit of the tree of humanity doesn't mean that we should go and wantonly destroy the rest of the tree of humanity. There obviously is a purpose that God embedded within nature. If indeed this is an accurate depiction of the family of man, then there is a purpose for all of us to exist, Jew and non-Jew alike, even if there is an inherent difference and an inherent superiority that exists within the Jew. So, I want to just mention one more idea, because there's so much more that we have to get to. Do me a favor and hold on to this for next time, because we didn't even have a chance to touch on the Rambam yet. And so the other thing... Yeah, so there's the Rambam I want to discuss with you, because the Rambam, I believe, disagrees very, very dramatically with Rebbe Yehuda Halevi. But the last thing that I wanted to leave you with is that for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, what is the singular essential difference between Jews and non-Jews? We have to be very careful to define this. Does it have to do with intelligence?
No.
Does it have to do with physical superiority?
No.
God, no, right? does it have to do with what is the essential difference between Jews and non-Jews? Yes.
Well, I took a note from what you said. Like you said, that the character of the non-Jew gets infused in the winemaking. Can it be character?
Well, that's not. But just look at Halevi. Just look at what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi himself is saying. What is the Jew capable of that the non-Jew is not capable of? The prophetic experience. The ability to have a prophetic experience. So, let's think about this for a second. How many of you are prophets in this room? Raise your hand. I don't see any hands raised. So, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is there any essential difference between you and a non-Jew? The only potential for differentiation and essential differences between Jews and non-Jews is that a Jew has the ability to become a prophet and a Gentile does not. According to the Talmud, prophecy ceased in the first generation of the Second Temple era. And the Talmud is very clear. Whether Rabbi Yehuda Halevi subscribes to this or not, I don't know. But the Talmud says that since the destruction of the Temple, referring to the First Temple, prophecy was removed from sane people, and it was given to insane people and children. That in itself is a statement that has to be unpacked, right? What it basically means is that all of those people that you think are psychotic and are having hallucinations, that's really prophecy from the Talmud, or at least sometimes it's prophecy from the Talmudic perspective. Yeah, in other words, they're having visions because for whatever reason God allows their filters to be askew, and they're able to see certain things that no one else can see, which is really what a type of prophetic experience. So a prophet does not exist anymore among any sane, lucid human being anymore. Now, if that's the case, and prophecy has not existed within our people for over probably close to 2,500 years, so then this is a non sequitur as far as defining essential differences. So to really answer the question is, what are the ramifications of this doctrine for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi? There are very few. I didn't say there are none, but there are very few. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is not the only voice that subscribes to this theology. And there are those, especially in the Zohar, which you got a foreshadowing of from Katz's text, that accentuate even more essential differences between Jews and non-Jews. But I've gotten into fights with people over this passage because when people superimpose their own conception of the differences between Jews and non-Jews, they read the Kuzari and they say, oh yeah, that's what I believe too. Oh really? So what's the difference between you and the non-Jew today? So they'll say the neshama, the this, da-da. Right, okay, fine. So how does that manifest itself? Well, our values then. Really? Is that what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says? Now, you may be correct according to the Zohar. You may be correct according to Hasidus. You may be correct according to other mystical texts. But just from looking at the Kuzari, we have to be very careful to analyze it objectively. Yeah, we'll take one more point, then we're going to go to the list.
These main differences, if you're going back to saying that only the non-Jews can have that experience, when we were back in the beginning with the Qasari and we were looking at Muhammad, for example, the difference, the way that it was being refuted was that it was, it didn't have witnesses, his prophetic experience. But there was, I remember some discussion that he may have had some types of prophecy, and that it wasn't so disputable except for the lack of witnesses. You were talking about the change in his demeanor when he came out, etc., etc. Prophets in the non-Jewish world.
Yes, I was, and that's very good that you picked up on that. So that's a good segue into our preview for next week's discussion, where we're going to learn the view of the Rambam, of Maimonides, who is a believer in the ability for non-Jews to prophesy, and we're going to get into that next time. Okay.